So, Anne, the APS Congress was held last year in September, and I know that there was a debate on the topic being individual happiness is the path to world peace. So I'm just wondering which team you would actually choose to belong to. Would you join the affirmative or the opposing team with respect to that question, that statement?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? I think that I probably would be more comfortable on the opposing team. Of course, there are never black and white answers to these things, to every complex problem. There's always a simple answer and it's always wrong. Somebody's quote that I'm always giving. But I think the reason why I would be more comfortable on the opposing team is because of that little word in the middle of the title of the topic, individual happiness is the path to world peace. I think it can be a contributor to world peace, having models of people living peaceful lives and being at ease with themselves, being, you know, well-functioning, well-centered people certainly can help promote peace in their interactions, and they can have an influence over the world. But I don't believe it is the path to world peace. I think we've got lots of examples of really influential people who've done great good in the world, who have still been very troubled themselves, not at all at peace with themselves, and yet they have been very effective. You can think of Gandhi, you can think of all sorts of people who've been troubled but yet been very positive influences in the world. I think, you know, it's a bit the question of top-down or bottom-up. Do you create peace by, you know, international agreements and that filters down to more peaceful societies? Or can we, you know, make peace at home and that will filter up to have an influence at a global level? And I think the answer is probably there's a bit of both, but we can't rely on that trickle-up effect for trying to create world peace. I certainly know for myself, if I were to say, well, I can't get involved in peace work until I've sorted myself out, I probably still wouldn't be involved in peace work. So I think we accept ourselves where we are, and of course we're always in a continuous process of, you know, trying to make ourselves into a better or more complete or more people that we can be comfortable with ourselves. But I don't think that precludes us from saying there are things I can do in the world, even given my imperfections. So, yeah, it's not either or, but I'd be more comfortable to say no, individual happiness isn't the path to world peace.
So, and from what you're saying, I understand that it's not even a significant contributor, really.
Oh, is it a significant contributor?
Possibly not.
You know, I've been in all sorts of interactions with people when they've said, or like, you know, at one stage we had a campaign about war toys, kids playing with guns and stuff like that. And I remember being in meetings with the manufacturers and retailers of war toys, and who are always blokes. And they would say things like, well, I grew up playing cowboys and Indians and look, I'm all right. And I was always tempted to say, well, perhaps you'd have been an even more sweet and gentle person if you hadn't, because they always said those things in a very aggressive way. So so the way in which I think that individual peace can be very important is your message doesn't get across very well if you're giving it in a very aggressive and confrontative sort of way.
Yes.
It doesn't gel with the message you're trying to put forward. You know, I do think that things like the way we handle conflicts and dilemmas is basically the principles behind that are the same whether you are talking about you know, with your intimate partner or your boss or your, you know, the other groups in the community or international conflict. So if you're not able to apply that sort of perspective taking and empathy in your own personal relationships, then you're probably less likely to be able to see the other side of the picture if you're talking about a, you know, a conflict between Aboriginal people and the government or between Palestinians and Israelis or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect there are crossovers in that way.
Mm. And so do you think then one's capacity to reflect becomes important in that process of interacting?
I think so. You know, I think there are just so many ways to build a more peaceful world, and people approach it in so many different ways. Having respect for the different approaches that people take, even, you know, for people who are doing it, academic research on intergroup relations, and they're doing it with the main goal is to promote their career,
mm-hmm.
they're still coming up with valuable, they can be coming up with really valuable information, and we should be grateful for them for doing it. They might not be approaching it from a peaceful perspective at all. They might not be good perspective takers or reflective people at all.
Yes.
So I think it's really important to be very open to the contributions that everybody makes wherever they're coming from.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very, it's a general, generous attitude, isn't it? Like being accepting and inclusive and respectful.
Yeah. And, you know, and I have been at peace conferences where the interactions haven't been particularly that way,
mm-hmm.
but I still wouldn't have any doubt that the individuals involved, the values were basically the right ones.
Yeah.
But whatever is getting in the way in terms of their way of communicating their differences of opinion with other people, I suppose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in terms of your own work then, how's it changed the way you live or your perspective on life? Is that...
Well, I guess being exposed to these ideas all the time does help you to be reflective. It does help you to see things through other people's eyes. So I'm sure that, you know, teaching and researching on conflict resolution and how we can raise our children to be more peaceful individuals,
mm-hmm.
Things like that, all does affect my general way of approaching life. I expect it's helped me to be more empathic, I guess. Certainly in terms of my attitudes towards child rearing, I mean, that's a place where there's a crossover between...
Mm.
what you might label my peace psychology work and my mainstream developmental psychology work. And they do cross over. Basically, what we know about good parenting that helps bring up, helps children to grow up to be well-adjusted and with high self-esteem and being successful and happy and healthy. Those are the things that help them to be peaceful as well.
Mm.
So it's very much the same thing. So I suppose my wish for children to be non-aggressive, to be cooperative, to be not too competitive, all of those things is where my understanding of developmental psych and of peace psych in
crossover. Yeah, it's a huge crossover, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm.
Well, I could continue and ask the next question.
Okay.
Just in relation to, just in terms of what you've just said, because it overlaps with two of the projects that you've been involved in, the Australian Temperament Project, and there's another one, Growing Up in Australia, which is the longitudinal study of Australian children. And they've both been really successful in engaging a multidisciplinary team, and they've also impacted on shaping public policy. And we often hear that peace psychology needs an interdisciplinary approach, and also something that's practical that actually impacts on the world around us. So are there things that peace psychology as a discipline can learn from, you know, your own experiences in engaging in that kind of research?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, isn't it? I guess these two projects, so the Australian Temperament Project has been going now for 34 years, I suppose.
Is it the longest running longitudinal research?
It's at least one of the longest running longitudinal studies in Australia.
In Australia,
but
yeah.
we have followed a large sample with I think we have 16 waves of data collection.
Mm-hmm.
So our participants started out as babies, and they're now in their 30s and having their own babies, and we're following their babies.
Wow!
So that's very exciting.
So this is the socialization process in a microscope,
extent,
anyway.
Yeah. And then growing up in Australia, the Longitudinal Study of Australian Children, our first data collection for that was in 2004,
mm-hmm.
With 10,000 kids across Australia. And you're right. I mean, I have found it really rewarding to be working with people from different disciplinary backgrounds. It certainly widens your horizons, and it certainly helps also in terms of impact with policy. And the other thing that I've learned through this too is how important building strong relationships with policymakers and with practitioners is if you want your research to make any difference,
mm-hmm.
On the ground.
Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, I suppose one example of that, I suppose, was around about the year 2000, I moved to the Australian Institute of Family Studies, and I moved the Australian Temperament Project there with me. And by then we had 20 years of fairly rich data, and we thought we were coming up with a lot of things that were policy relevant, to do with educational policies, to do with mental health policies and services,
mm-hmm.
To do with parenting advice and things like that. But we were publishing in the academic journals, but they were having very little impact at a policy or practice level, mm-hmm. and that was very frustrating. Moving to the Institute of Family Studies, which is a government agency,
mm-hmm.
I suddenly was having conversations with policymakers, and they got really excited. They had no idea that data set was there. Because we were publishing in the academic journals, what policymaker has time to read those?
Yeah, sure.
So that was a time when, a bit like now actually, that was a time when people were really concerned about youth crime.
Mm-hmm.
But the Victorian government had a crime prevention branch unit, and they got very interested in our data about how kids became involved in antisocial behaviour, which kids became involved, and even more importantly, which kids looked like they were on a path towards delinquency but then veered off and became well-adjusted,
mm-hmm.
Adolescents. And so we worked with the crime prevention people and had a advisory group that included the cops and the justice system and teachers, people in service delivery, and they basically guided the sorts of questions that we asked of the data and were involved all the way through in seeing the data as it was coming out. So that was turned out to be really important, that ministers could be advised, you know, a report is coming out which is saying X, you need to know about that so you can think about how you're going to respond,
mm-hmm.
giving them that heads up ahead of time. And, you know, so we did a number of big reports came out on that and got disseminated really widely. One of our problems was we hadn't budgeted for dissemination. Oh. But we kept on being asked to go and give workshops with bunches of school principals or with people in the children's court or with the police and things like that. So, but that was very gratifying to see evidence-based policies coming out from the work that we had done. Mm-hmm. And it was because we had built these strong, trusting relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And could talk from more than a straight psychological perspective. We had criminologists and sociologists and educators mm-hmm. in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that was one example of working together and making an impact.
That's terrific.
So how do we translate that sort of stuff to peace psychology? I guess it really depends. I certainly think for people who are engaging in research, it's really important to say, what do I want? Say to yourself, how do I want this research to influence what's going on the ground?
Mm-hmm.
And actually to be thinking about, who do I need to be bringing on board at this stage to help me guide my research questions so it's going to be useful for them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you are talking about kids and racism or bullying programs in schools or how kids are responding to climate change or something.
Mm-hmm.
Who needs to know? Who needs to be part of this? Who can help to be implementing anything we find? How can they be part of this? And really having a partnership, so not being too purist about, this is the question that I want to ask and how I want to ask it, but to be guided
mm-hmm.
Guided by others in that sort of partnership model.
Mm, so it's not really, this is my turf, be doing this research on this.
Yeah, but I have these resources and I have these skills that I can contribute and here's the issue that I care about, how can we build this up together?
Mm-hmm. So yeah. Does that mean that universities at the level, when you've got PhD students, for instance, engaging, would it start even there?
Yeah, I think it certainly can. And there is now so much more of a acknowledgement about the importance of knowledge translation, of knowledge exchange,
mm-hmm.
That I think it's getting easier. I think we're starting to get out of our ivory towers and,
mm-hmm.
But we are still not, we don't really teach our students very well how to do that sort of stuff. Most of us still have to learn from the seat of our pants, really. So I think it's an important thing to include in education.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's a very broad kind of perspective, isn't it? Because it's a long-term perspective and it's a wider perspective than, say, just thinking about your research question. And
getting it published in a high-status journal,
yeah.
which still tends to be the thing that gets most rewarded in terms of a career. But I think that, again, we're starting to be a bit broader in our way of what we'll acknowledge as being a useful contribution.
What's valuable.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
That's great, Anne.